You're listening to the Empty Stringers podcast, where every week we talk about locating, catching, and the conservation of redfish. My hope is to share with you what I'm seeing from the polling platform so that together we can catch more fish. Think of it as your weekly fishing report. Welcome back to the podcast, folks. I'm your host, Matt Parrish, and we have a great episode for you this week. My guest is one of the pioneers of skinny water red fishing along the Texas coast. He's lived a storied life full of adventure and in recent years stumbled his way into legend status among the fishing community. He spent over 22 years with the Houston Police Department, 13 of those in the homicide division. He's guided along the Texas and Louisiana coast for over 19 years, and he's been married to his sweet wife, Camille, for 36 years and counting. He's a founding member of the Bite Me podcast. He's my mentor and friend, and I am delighted to welcome him to the Empty Stringers podcast. Here is my conversation with Captain Scott Knoll.
Let's see here.
We are live. Scott Knoll, Captain Scott Knoll, thanks for coming on this little rinky-dink Empty Stringers podcast. Welcome aboard.
I appreciate you having me, man.
I was thinking about this beforehand. I think we met probably 2 or 3 years ago. But I think our first meeting was on the phone when you had your shoulder injury.
Yeah.
And I called and said, "Hey, let's do an over the phone trip. Because I'm having trouble figuring this out. And there are places I was afraid to go because I was afraid they were too shallow. There were things I wasn't piecing it all together." And I remember, you probably don't remember that conversation because you get a lot of that. But I remember you telling me, "How deep are you fishing?" I told you I was catching flounder. I was catching, you know, a few speckled trout and usually a rat red. But I was having a hard time keying in on the slot redfish. And you said, "How deep are you fishing?" And I said, two and a half feet. And you said, "You're fishing too shallow." And
You were fishing too shallow or too deep?
Fishing too deep. Yeah. You said, I'm fishing too deep. I need to go shallower. And I was like, "What? You lost your mind." And that was the beginning of me unlocking and listening to everything that you would say on the Bite Me podcast and listening to, you know, fished with you a couple of times. And through that, you dropped breadcrumbs along the way, whether you intended to or not, that helped me piece together the whole program. And I dabble at guiding. I'm a part-time guide. I'm still running my business and doing all that. But I said this before the show kicked off, but you taught me everything I know, whether you intend to or not. And yes. I can only imagine that I am not the only, one that is true for. And so my question for you on that is, there are a lot of people, I would imagine, especially in Port O'Connor. We were down there a couple of weeks ago. Oh my God, there's a boat at every turn. There's a boat pushing every shoreline. Do you get annoyed with how many people are trying to do what you do and maybe like following your footsteps? Or are you kind of like, "Hey, I've got to hand this off to someone at some point"? You know, what's your mentality on that?
In the beginning, it got to me a little bit. You know, it was like, I have to put it out there in order to get customers about what I'm doing. Because what I was doing was so totally different from anybody else that nobody really understood what I was trying to get done. And I knew there was an audience for it. I knew there were customers for it. And the only way to get it out there was to write about it and talk about it. And it just kind of became a part of what I was doing. Having to accept that people I took out fishing were going to go buy a poling skiff and go back where I was fishing. And over time, it just kind of got to where I was just like, yeah, whatever. You know, when I left Galveston, when I started Galveston, there was only two polling skiffs there. It was me and one other guy who's an old DEA agent. And we were both back there in the marshes. He stayed mostly on the south side of West Bay, and I was on that north side and doing greens and going over to East Bay, fishing over in there a good bit, and all back up in Chocolate and anywhere that I could push way back and get away from everybody.
Yeah.
Only other people back there were kayaks. And the last day that I fished Galveston before I officially moved to Port O'Connor, I went to the Buc-ee's there on I-45, and there were 9 polling skiffs getting gas.
Wow.
It was a big change. Huge change.
And the time span, what was that time span?
Oh, probably 10 years, give or take, somewhere around there. Maybe a little bit longer. But the change, it was slow in the beginning, but then all of a sudden it just steamrolled. Yeah, the first few polling skiffs that started coming back there were doing what you were doing. Yeah, they were fishing too deep. And they were out in the main lake, you know, or out on the main shorelines, and they weren't going back where I went. They weren't pushing back in there. And then some pictures got out, some customers that took some pictures of some crazy places that I was going in the back, and some of those pictures started coming out. And that was, you know, when Facebook was really kicking in. And next thing I know, I'm starting to see more of them pushing a little further back and a little further back. And I'd see a whole lot of them sitting out on the main lake watching me. Yeah, I can't tell you how many people I saw with binoculars standing there on the main lake looking back there at me. I had some guys that stopped me one day while I was coming out, and they said, "We didn't even know there was water back there."
Yeah.
Yeah. I had one guy that stopped me. I'd work my way around on the east side of Greens, and I'd worked so far back up in there, I was almost back to the intercoastal. You know, you're shaking your head, you know where I'm talking about.
Oh yeah, I know exactly.
And nobody was in there ever. And I'd worked way back in there. I mean, it was so small that I couldn't hardly turn the boat in the corners. You know, it was all these little twisty bodies, but I could hear redfish feeding back there. It was in the fall and they were just chomping. And I kept going further and further back there, and I finally worked my way into this one pond. It was a really cool little pond, and the fish were just raking it, you know, just going back and forth. And I'm back there just sitting and watching mostly, and had customers come in the next few days. I just wanted to see what they were doing. And this guy pulls up on the intercoastal. I was so far back in there, when he pulled up on the edge of the intercoastal, he could talk to me.
Yep.
And he's like, "What are you stuck? How the hell did you get your boat stuck there?" I said, "No, man, I'm floating. I pulled in here." And he's just shaking his head. And he's like, I thought you needed help. I couldn't figure out how you had wrecked your boat so bad that you were up there. And now I'm back here. He says, "Are there fish back there?" I said, "Yeah, there's some fish in here." And he shook his head. He's like, "I can't ever get there." So those are the kind of things that happened in the beginnings of it that I just figured there's a whole lot of people not going to go through the effort to get where I was going.
Yeah.
And that's the way it kind of stayed that way for a long time. And then eventually a few more people started pushing a little further in, a little further in. I hated the high tides, the super high tides, not so much because it scattered the fish or any of that. I could find the fish even on super high tides. I could go back in there and get way in and find some fish. But it allowed other boats to come in there because everybody was scared when it was low tides.
Yep.
And they wouldn't go in. But when a high tide would come up, man, there'd be boats running around. And the worst part was they were afraid to stop. They wanted to go see it. And so they started just running around back there a whole lot. And things changed. You know, that changed the fishing a little bit. It broke up a lot of the schools. And I didn't find the gigantic schools like I had in the past. And it just slowly changed over time.
It's interesting to hear you say some of those things, because a lot of that stuff is still happening. So I see, I'll be out, I see some guys with polling skiffs that have the equipment to do what I do, but are afraid to go for it because I started geeking out about water level because of that conversation we had, the few years ago. And so I really started paying close attention to tide levels, water levels, what it was going to do, where I was going to have water, you know. And the Weekend Warrior guys, it's one of the reasons I try to, it's a catch 22. I try to teach them that in the podcast, but I know that in teaching some people that they're going to eventually turn around and just do the same thing I'm doing. But I see guys all the time with the equipment to get back there, but not the guts or the experience to go back, you know, in the back corners. But and some people think that they are, you know, they think that they're in the back, and then I'm like, no, there's a lot of marsh back there, man. Like, you can really get lost back there. But the schooling of the redfish and the size of schools that you used to see back there, I was having this debate with a buddy not that long ago who was telling me that, like, nah, I think the redfish are, like, you know, as good as they've ever been. And I'm like, I don't think so, man. I think, like, I would love to hear your take on that and how good it was, you know, in the yonder years.
Well, I mean, you're going to hear it all the time from everybody that's fished in the past. It's not as good as it used to be. And sometimes you kind of get to a point of, they're just, you know, rose-colored glasses. They're living in the past. I can tell you for a fact that it was better. There were times when I would fish back there and be on school, literal schools of 50, 60, 100, easily, you know, anytime, and then come into schools of 500, 600, 700 more fish. Wow. And they would just be roaming. It would look like just a herd of fish coming across one of those lakes. Also, the lakes weren't what they are now. I look at it on Google Earth now, I wouldn't recognize half of it.
Yeah.
Because there's so much of it that's deteriorating and gone away. We had a whole lot more small lakes and little bayous and little connectors. A lot of the places that are wide open now were cut off lakes that you had to push through marsh grass to get into. There was no real entrance to it. And if it did have an entrance, it might be big enough for the boat. It might not.
Yeah.
Everything's eroded so much back there. But those schools would get into one of those lakes like that, and they'd stay in there as long as the shrimp were there. Until they ate every last shrimp out of that thing, they would stay in there. And they'd just get bigger and bigger. My theory on the schools, the biggest ones were always after the first few cold fronts. It'd start off August, September. There'd be some small schools, 5, 10, 15, 20 fish. There'd be a lot of them, but just a whole lot of small schools. Those were fun days. They were great because you're going from school to school.
Yeah.
You know, you never had a real slow time. Then after a cold front, my theory of all marshes, and even down here in Port O'Connor, we have kind of the same thing that I saw just last week. When the tide gets ripped out like that on those fronts, all those fish got to go somewhere. They got to go to the deeper water. All those small schools fall off into deeper water. Well, the first few fronts don't blow all the water out, but they make it pretty shallow. Yep. So they fall off into some holes, and there's more holes that'll hold fish. Immediately following the front, water comes back. Those schools come up out of those holes, and they're a little bigger. So when I would see those biggest schools would be after that bad, bad front that hits around Thanksgiving. Blows all the water out, and the water stays out for 2 days, 3 days. They fall off into the very few really deep holes. It was the only place that there was any water. A lot of those were cut off. They couldn't even go out into the main lake if they wanted to. And then after a front like that, when the water came back up, count on it. Man, there was going to be schools of 100-plus fish, and they'd be all over the place. They're easier to find, but they're harder to fish because you're only going to get one. And then they're going to blow up. That's
the frustrating thing, yeah.
Yeah. So, but yes, there was, I think I've told you about it. There was a time when I'd followed these schools. They worked their way around kind of clockwise around the back lakes of the back end of Greens. And I worked them and worked them, followed them. And I guess they were just following the shrimp. I don't know if they were, what they were doing or why they were doing it, but they were, they started off on the west side. They went around the northwest, all around the north, ended up in the northeast pond when a big front hit and blew them all out. Caught a whole bunch of fish on the way out. Tides came back a couple of days later, stayed up pretty good, and I couldn't find my schools. I was just frustrated, man. I was looking all over. I said, man, they did not go out because the shrimp didn't leave on that front.
Yeah.
It wasn't the real bad front that pushes them out and keeps it cold. The shrimp were still around. And so I was scratching my head, and I went into that northeast corner where the man-made stuff is.
Yeah.
And there's that little pocket that goes to the north from there. I say little pocket. It's pretty damn big. And I'm pulling around. I had two guys on the front, and I'd been telling about all these schools, and, of course, I'm not finding them. And they're just looking at me. But they fished with me before, so they knew I was getting frustrated not finding them. And I pulled around over there, and I saw a couple of birds kind of hanging over that section of water. So I eased over there, take a look. And that entire pocket, it's a pretty good size. Shoreline to shoreline was redfish.
Oh.
I mean, I've never seen anything like it. I mean, how many redfish would it take to fill that up? I mean, several thousand.
Yeah.
And it was absolutely stuffed with redfish. They were
good
everywhere.
God almighty.
And the whole water was just kind of shaking, and it was only like maybe 8 inches to a foot deep.
Yep.
Why they went back there, I have no idea. But they were in there, and it was just crazy. And I eased up to it, and I told the guys, I said, man, I don't know how this is going to go because I've never run into it before. And it was fly fishing. I said, I'm going to ease up there, and we're going to see if we can catch some satellite fish right at that, because where it kind of narrows down,
you know,
to get in there. And the fish were cruising right up against that opening. And I said, we're going to ease up there and see if we can pick some off and maybe keep them from freaking out.
Blowing up.
We did it. We pulled one out, we pulled another one out, and then he hooked one of the upper size. This was all different size fish too, of course, with that many in there. And one of the guys hooked one of the upper slots, if not an over, and it turned and burned all the way into his backing, straight into that cove. And I swear to you could hear redfish, it just that whoosh when a school blows up.
Yep.
It was whoosh for, I don't know, a minute and a half, 2 minutes.
Oh,
redfish thumping into the boat, thumping, going crazy. And they scattered out. And I said, well, I don't know if we're over or if we just started a really good day. And it turned out it started a really, really good day because they all went into that one lake and broke up into schools of 50 to 100, 200 fish. And we're just cruising around in that lake feeding the rest of the day. And I don't know. If I'd have gone, the crazy part is, you know, there's days when you go in there and you never find a fish. It happens. You know, everybody thinks you're a guide, you're going to find fish every day. Well, there's days when you go in there and you just pole and pole and pole and don't see a fish. And you wonder, what the hell? I think that's what happens. They all are in one spot. I just happened to look into figuring out where they had gone.
Those stories right there haunt me because I have those days too, right? Where you're like, you're pulling around and especially so I get into those times when, like you said, especially in the fall, I see it more in the fall than I do in the spring, but in the fall I can see, all right, I've got schools of fish that are working this area and they're going to work that area until the shrimp are depleted. And then they're going to move one lake over and they're going to work that for a week or two. And then they're going to move another lake over and I'll follow those fish from one end of the marsh all the way to the other end of the marsh, whether it be, you know, whatever marsh I'm in. And the thing that drives me nuts is you have those random days when you show up and something is off. And they're not schooling. They're not doing their thing. It doesn't happen that often. But when it happens, especially when you got customers on the front of the boat, like, man, I always think to myself, they're piled up somewhere. And I can't figure out where. Like, they're having a prayer meeting. on one end of the, you know, this marsh, and I can't figure it out, you know, and it drives me insane. Have you ever had customers on the boat and, you know, you slayed it the day before or whatever, and you completely strike out, don't catch a fish with customers on the boat?
Not when I've slayed it the day before.
Yeah.
If I've been on a streak, I'll eventually figure them out throughout the day. But there are times when, you know, it's been okay. You know, it's been pretty good. We've had some fish, nothing to write home about, but it's, you know, it's steady. And then all of a sudden, poof, I don't know what the hell happened. I don't know where they went. Don't know what they're doing. But also I've had some really strange, complete shifts where these fish were in schools. I was in Pierce years ago. And it was before they even put in all the man-made stuff in Pierce. A long time ago. And I was back there, and the whole thing, it was before they had started all that work, and the water would get really, really clear in there. And I was in the main big lake, and I'd had good schools just scattered around the lake chasing shrimp. Everything was nice. It was working. I pulled in there. Of course, that's the worst for you too, is because I had regular customers, so I was talking a lot of crap about how many fish I'd been seeing, how many fish we've been catching. And we got a good day coming up.
Guilty.
I pull in there and I start polling, and I ain't seen a school yet. I mean, nothing. And it's early, early in the morning. So I'm polling around. I'm just, you know, you stare at the shorelines all the way around you looking for a ripple, anything. And I've got nothing. I mean, it's just dead. But man, I see some birds on the other side. There were some egrets, little snowy egrets walking the shoreline. I said, maybe they found the first school. You know, maybe it'll fire up when the sun comes up. So I start pulling all the way across. I was on the diversionary side.
Mm-hmm.
And I was pulling all the way across. Got out there in the middle, and the sun was up pretty good by then, you know, 9:30, 10 o'clock. We ain't seen a fish yet. And I get out there in the middle, and I look down, and there's a big redfish just cruising next to the boat in like two to 3 feet of water. You can see the bottom. You know, it was really good and clear. I think it was a December time.
Yeah.
And I look down. I said, man, what the hell? I look over, and there's another fish cruising. There's another fish cruising. Then there comes three. Every fish in that lake had broken up, no longer in schools. And the biggest group we saw all day was like three to four fish. And they were in the middle of the lake, cruising around and feeding like crazy. I have no idea what they were eating, but you could tell they weren't just kind of cruising lazy. They were moving, and then you'd see squirrels, and it was all out in the middle of the damn lake. I have no idea why they did that. I go back in there the next day with more customers. I'm like, got it figured out, got a pattern. Pull in there, schools. They completely switched. They went from schools to singles to schools in 3 days.
Yeah, it's so weird. I've had some of my best days ever in December, and then go back. I had a day with my son on the boat where we must have seen 150, 200 fish, and clear, beautiful water, and then went back there 2 days later with a customer. They're gone. We caught fish that day, but it wasn't where I saw those 200 fish. I had to scratch my head and go like pull something out of the back pocket. You know what I mean? And it seems to be, you know, at the most inopportune times. Monday of last week, I ran a rare Monday trip. I normally only run trips on Thursdays and Fridays. And I had a father and son out, and we had one of the best days ever. I mean, the day was so good that when it was quitting time, we were riding back to the dock and we saw two schools of redfish. And I said, do you guys want to stop and catch a couple more? And they're like, nah, we're good.
Yeah.
And then Thursday, I had a guy coming out who listens to the podcast, and he got stuck in a freeway closure accident. So he was supposed to be at the dock at 6:30. His name's Mark. Good guy, loyal listener. And, you know, one of those guys that doesn't get to take off work that often, took off work, got his brother out of school, coming down, couldn't sleep the night before, so excited. Accident happens at 6:10 a.m. He was 2 miles from the Bayou Vista exit to get to Lewis's Bait Camp. He got stuck behind that wreck. He didn't get to Lewis's Bait Camp till 10:30 a.m.
Damn.
And I knew because of just being out there on the water, like the pattern right now, at least for the morning bite, is it's over with at 10 o'clock. Your trip may last till noon. It may last till 1 or 2 o'clock. The chances of you catching a fish between 10 and 2 o'clock right now, not that good, you know? I just felt terrible for the guy. And I'm like, man, I pulled him around for a couple hours of where he's going to reschedule. But when you know it's over, but you don't want to ruin their hopes, but you also want to set expectations where they ought to be. You know, it's just it's a fine line to play, you know?
You got to read the customers. You know, some guys get really, really discouraged if they're not seeing fish. Other guys, they're going to fish hard whether you're seeing them or not. They're just enjoying being out there.
Yeah.
Most of the ones I see, you know, that are like that, office guys, they don't get out that often, and they really just enjoy the being out there. They feel like they've got a cheat day. They took off on a weekday. And they're just happy. You know, if we see some fish, great. If we don't see fish, that's okay. And most of what I find that is, I mean, I know I hear all the time, the elitist fly fishermen, whatever, but it's mostly fly guys.
Yep.
And the fly guys are just happy. They just enjoy being out there. Shots at fish, they don't even have to catch them most of the time. You know, if I got 10 shots at the fish, you know, today, that was awesome. You know, I had my opportunities. So that's where you kind of end up tailoring your way of communicating, I guess, to the different customers and their different attitudes. You know, what I did in the past, I had to read people pretty quick. And I read folks on the boat, you know, early in the morning. Most of what I have these days are guys who have fished with me in the past or they're listeners to the Biting Podcast. They know what I'm about. They know, you know, they know what to expect getting on the boat. Very rarely do I just have somebody just showing up that has no clue, you know, how I fish or what to expect throughout the day. So I'm lucky in that way that I've developed enough of a clientele that.
Well, it took 20 years. I mean, you've been at this a long time, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it does take a long time to get there.
Because when you started, you were like you said, you were one of two poling skiffs in the area. I can only imagine the number of phone calls and, you know, people reaching out to go, hey, my family's coming down. We want to take the kids out, all that stuff. Like, that had to drive you insane. And what the number one reason why I started this podcast was I saw how with you and the Bite Me podcast, you're not getting those calls anymore because people know what you do. It was a medium. And like with the day and age that we live in, podcast is the medium that everyone, you know, everyone gravitates to. It's like, it's an easy way to go, look, this is who I am and this is what I do. And it's made it a lot easier for me to paint the picture for the customer before they book me. You spent a lot of years going, hey, I don't do that. go fish with James Hogg or whoever, you know.
Well, I had a whole list of guys that did those trips. But the return on that was, fly fishing was starting to come around. People were starting to get into fly fishing, and all those guys knew that that's what I did. So if they got that call, which wasn't nearly as often as I was getting the call for them,
I bet. But
if they did get that call for a sight casting or somebody who's just said, man, I just really want to catch redfish, So they would send them to me. Yeah. And because they were trout guys and they didn't care anything about or didn't understand how to go find redfish. And so it was a trade off. It was back and forth. But I was also writing for the Texas Saltwater Fishing Magazine. So I was able to get it out there that way. The biggest kickoff for me was Texas kayak fishing. The old message. I was doing the kayak fishing thing. I was fishing tournaments. Dean and I were winning, a bunch of tournaments. And so it got kind of popular through that. People were following how we were doing on their tournaments and going to Florida and fishing all over. And everybody kept saying, you ought to be a guide. You ought to be a guide. And I knew that's where I was headed. And so my beginnings of it, when I got in the skiff, were telling kayak guys, they were wanting to go out and need to guide them on kayaks. I tried that a little bit. That's like herding cats, man.
Oh, yeah.
It drove me nuts because I couldn't teach them anything. And I like being a teaching guide. And what I found was I would be finding fish, and then I'm looking around, where the hell they go? Yep. I need to show them what these fish are doing. And I don't want to catch them. I want them to catch them. Yep. And so I got to a point where I think I even wrote a couple of articles about it. If you're a kayak fisherman and you want to learn how to fish shallow water and what to look for and how to catch reds, come get on the bow of my poling skiff. I go to the same places that the kayaks go, but with you on the bow and me on the back, I can tell you what I'm looking at and why I'm going where I'm going. And so that's what really got me started, was teaching people in that manner. And that way they learned how to spot fish, the difference between a mullet and a redfish moving across a flat. All the little things that you pick up over time. And it kind of doubled with what you were talking about at the beginning. I'm taking guys out that couldn't go where I went.
Yeah.
Because it was too far to paddle.
Yep.
So they were fishing similar kind of marshes and areas, but it was areas they could access. And I was going into places that they just couldn't get to a whole lot. And so it didn't really affect me a whole lot in the beginning until people started buying poling skiffs, getting out of kayaks and buying poling skiffs. Then that's when it started changing a little bit.
Well, yeah, you get a couple of trips on the bow of a poling skiff and you're really disgusted at that kayak after that, you just like, man. And honestly, that's why my progression from a kayak to a skiff was the same way. I looked at the map and was like, there are places I need to go. And I ain't paddling 15 miles to get to the place I want to fish. Like, I need to be able to get there, Yeah. And that's what changed the game for me. But you've been fishing for a long time. You fished the Texas coast, all your life. You moved you made a shift at some point into chasing tarpon and getting the bigger boat. You've got the 26-foot Freedom General. When did you do that? And what was the reasoning behind it? Was it just because you loved it, or did you notice that, like, there are some months out of the year that are tougher to do the redfish poling thing, and you wanted to shift into something that made more sense during those times? Or, like, how did that happen?
A little bit of everything. I've been doing the redfish thing for so long. I hate to say I'm bored with it, because I'm not, but doing it 12 months, I was getting burned out on it. I'm just doing redfish every day. And then there's the period when the tarpon are here, just so happens that the red fishing's kind of tough in the shallows.
Yep.
In July, August, we got water temperatures this past year that were in the 90s up in the in those little back lakes.
Yep.
And I'd tell people, you want to go for redfish? We can. It's going to be over with by 9 o'clock. Yes, there are days, I hear about it all the time. Oh, you said that the redfish quit at 9 o'clock. Well, we were catching them at noon. It happens.
Sure.
And it's fishing. There's no real rules. But day in, day out, those redfish quit. When that sun gets up and it gets hot, the redfish in the places I like to chase them.
Exactly.
Yeah, you can go fish some deeper water redfish, and you can blind cast, and you can do all those things, and you can still catch some fish. But the redfish that I like to target in 6, 8, 10 inches of water quit. I mean, they'll go to sleep. I mean, they go into kind of like a trance. And I find them all the time where they're just sitting in the grass and they're just kind of rocking almost back and forth. And you can put a fly in front of them, you put a lure in front of them, you can do anything you want to, poke them with a push pole and they'll finally move. And yep. The only thing I just say they went to sleep. And I know what they're doing. They're conserving their energy because hot water doesn't hold oxygen and they need oxygen, obviously. So by conserving their energy, they can sit there and just be in that little trance, almost like going into hibernation and wait until it gets cooler again. They feed all night. And then you catch them that last part of the feed in the morning before it gets too hot again. And those are tough days when somebody says, man, I still want to go. Yeah, I want to go chase redfish. All right. And they book a half a day, you know, because I tell them, don't bother booking a full day.
Yeah.
Definitely won't do that. Let's book a half day. And then by 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, every fish we see is just laying down. And we still see plenty of them. We'll see trout doing it too. You know, big trout laying in the grass, not doing a damn thing. You can't make them do anything. And I always joke around with my customers and say, okay, just sit here and we're going to watch him. And when he yawns, try to throw it in his mouth.
You know, you and I did that. I think it was either last July or the July before that. I went out with you, booked a trip. Same deal. You said, hey, look, we're not seeing that many fish. I was like, I don't care. I want to come. I want to come glean whatever wisdom I can from, cause my thing is like, I know how to find them when it's easy. Like I want to see what you're doing when it's hard. Right. Yeah. And, we just so happened to have a really good day. We saw a lot of fish that day. But we did see fish that were in that trance and I see them, all the time in the areas that I fish doing the same thing. And I'm obsessed with, as you have been, trying to figure out, okay, where are they going? What are they doing when they stop schooling, when the feed is over? And I think you're spot on. I think they're sitting down in the mud and they're going to sleep. There are some fish that move off the flat, sure, but those bigger fish, I think they're all about conserving energy. They're going to sit down in a prop scar. They're going to sit down up against the grass and they're going to wait. I rolled across an area that I know you've been in 1,000 times in my neck of the woods. It was one of those days when the tide was really too low for me to have gone back there. I was cutting it a little too close for comfort. But that's kind of how I like to roll now. But I get into this back lake and I can't stop. If I stop, I'm screwed. As I'm rolling, I see something sticking out of the water over off to my left. As I get closer, it's a redfish that has fallen asleep in the mud and the tide's gone out and his back is sticking out of the water and he doesn't care. He's sound asleep, you know, and it's just, it boggled my mind that those fish will do those kinds of things. You know, it's super weird.
One of the first times I ran into it was my buddy, Jason Bryant. I don't think you've met him yet, but, had Jason and I, we were kayak fishing and there's a little bitty lake over by San Luis Pass up in Bastrop Bay. It's a little satellite lake off the side of that. It is the muddiest, nastiest lake I've ever been in. And I've been in some mud. And going into the entrance of it, it's hard bottom, you know, no problem. And it's like thigh deep. And we got out of the kayaks and we could see the fish up there. And we were getting ready for a tournament. It was all oversized bull reds. And it was a catch, photo, and release tournament. So we could have an oversized fish. And they were literally laying all over this lake. It looked like a bunch of dead fish. And there was several dozen of them. And they were spread out. They weren't in schools. They were just spread out all over the place. And there was two little fingers where the drain out of that lake cut around the side of this one little island at the entrance. And I went up one and he went up the other. And we're looking at each other from, you know, 30 yards apart, casting to these fish. And they would move, but they were just barely moving. I mean, just like creeping along. And it wasn't like they were feeding, creeping. You know, it wasn't like they were hunting. And Jason finally caught one by dead sticking a gulp. He threw a gulp out there and just laid it there. And this one redfish was moving, inching along. And it just happened to inch over the top of it, I guess. And just, I don't know if it sucked it in or if he foul hooked it, honestly. But that was the only fish we caught out of there that entire day. But it was hot. It was like August and just nasty hot. If you stepped out of that little channel, it was knee deep to thigh deep mud. It was just this nasty stuff. And these reds were just, I don't know, just in a trance, just kind of wandering around in there. When we went back to it on a little higher tide and earlier in the morning, we caught some.
Yeah, it's so, like they know. It's like they know that the tide, the tide is out. We know that. We're chilling out. We know it's coming back. You know, it's they know the weather better than we do, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They live it. You know, they get in that rhythm and they know if I just lay here for a little bit, water's coming back at some point. But back to the original question, yes, that's why I started doing the tarpon, was because there were times when I knew my trips were going to be super short, you know, and then I was, by 9 o'clock, it's going to be over. I still got this guy on the boat until noon.
Mm-hmm.
What do I do? You know, what the hell do I do with somebody for 3 hours when I know that the fish aren't going to be doing anything? So I'm always honest with everybody before I go out, just like I told you before we went, it's going to be over with pretty early. And some guys are like, that's fine. And then when it slows down, they'll turn around, look at me and say, it's over, isn't it? Yep, it's over. Well, let's just go on back. And then others just want to go explore and they want to see more. They want to talk about fishing. They want to, you know, pepper me with a bunch of questions or whatever. And that's fine too. That's what I'm out there for, teaching. But the tarpon thing gives me something else to do.
Yeah.
So I've got, let's start at the beginning of the year, January, February, I can find reds pretty good. You know, it's a little harder. You got to dodge weather. March and April, I hate. Don't like those months hardly at all. I end up canceling more trips than I run just because of the wind and the amount of wind that we're dealing with. Yes, you can fish in the wind. Yes, you can still catch fish in the wind. Poling and fly fishing in the wind is tough. Really, really hard.
Yeah.
And before anybody gets that wrong, I do both. I do conventional and I do fly. I prefer fly. I like, you know, I like the fly guys out there. I enjoy having them. But I do conventional as well. I got no problem with that. We're going to sight cast. We're going to do the same thing we do with through fly fishing. You're going to be able to blind cast a little more. Fly guys don't. So I prefer March and April. If you want to fly fish, bring your fly gear, but we're going to have a spinning rod on the boat just in case, because chances are good you're not going to be able to cast much.
Yeah.
Then come May is kick's butt. Now, I love May because typically we got some shrimp. The first shrimp hatch is going out. Then about middle of May, end of May, if I don't have a trip booked and the weather's calm enough, I'm running the beachfront. I started off doing it in Poland skiffs, my old East Cape. I ran the beachfront all the time in it. I wouldn't take customers, though, because that just seemed a little too sketchy to me. I went out there just because I enjoyed it. And I love chasing the tarpon and seeing the tarpon and the jacks and the bull reds and all that. And over time, in talking about it and talking to different people about it, they were like, man, I really like to go out there and do that. And so I kind of realized that there might have been a market for fly fishing for tarpon and bull reds and jacks and sight casting them and throwing, you know, lighter tackle. Most of the guys that do that are fishing super heavy tackle.
Yeah.
And doing it with light tackle, I figured, what the hell? Let me see what happens. So I got the Dargle and started running out there and got booked up, you know, pretty good. So around about middle of May, I'm going to start running out there to look. I know it's too early. I know they're not here yet, but I got to go look. And usually about the end of May, 1st of June, they'll start showing up. They're not real, real consistent. So through May and June, I'm doing both. I'm doing redfish trips. And come June, I'll start doing a few tarpon trips. Doesn't really get all that good in the front end of it. So, and the weather's still good enough for redfish throughout the bay. Getting to the end of June, into July, that's when those redfish will start going to sleep on you with the heat. So the beachfront is wide open. And typically that's when the winds die the most. And so I've got lower winds that I can go out there on the beachfront and go do what I want to do. July, August, September are all kind of like that. Then September, the tarpon fishing kind of builds and builds and builds. And that's the big crescendo of the tarpon fishing is the end of September. All the fish that moved past us further up the coast, our fish come from Mexico, go up the coast. Each area, say Aransas, while, you know, the jetties there, and the jetties in Port O'Connor, and on up Matagorda, the mouth of the Brazos. Everywhere there's an opening, some fish drop off and stay. Others keep going. Our fish go all the way, according to tracking, go all the way to Grand Isle.
Wow.
Everything west of the Mississippi, tarpon west of the Mississippi, are our Mexico fish for the most part. If they're east of the Mississippi, they're Florida fish. They do intermingle. There's, like, I watch all the tracking stuff, and there's some intermingling that goes on in that area. But for the most part, those are our fish that go over there. So the first few cold fronts, they start coming back. And as they come back, they stop wherever there's an opening. And Port O'Connor just happens to be one of the deep, the first of the deep water openings. And so we built, get a buildup of fish throughout September. And those fish, sometimes they'll stick around till middle October. And it can be really, really good. But that's crossing over into my redfish time again.
Yeah.
So, you know, I start getting to the end of September, starting into October. I'm itching to go back to the redfish again, hitting the tarpon on the good days, hitting the redfish on the windy days. And then my tarpon disappear and I cry for a day or two. And I go back out there and look for them again, and they're not there. And then I finally, you know, I have to have some counseling. And then it's time for me to just go back to redfish. And then so I do the redfish thing October, November, December, and my year starts over again.
Are you, if you had, I'm not going to pick a time of year, because I know that I know how your brain works. So let's take that out of it, right? I'm not going to say, hey, it's this month. Let's just say both are happening, right? Mm-hmm. And you have your choice. You got a day off. I'm going to push you around, or I'm going to motor you wherever you need to go. You get to do all the fishing. What are you going to go do? Are you going to go chase the tarpon, or are you going to go chase redfish?
Tarpon, 100% tarpon.
Really?
Yeah. I've caught way more redfish than I've caught tarpon.
Yeah. So you still feel like you got that itch to scratch.
Yeah. And I know redfish, I can do them 12 months out of the year.
Yeah.
Tarpon are only here for a very small period, and I take full advantage of it. Every day that there is a chance for me to go out there and play with tarpon, I go. My days off, Camille laughs at me, because there's times when I've run 5, 6, 7, 8 days straight, and I finally got a day or two off, and the weather's calm, and I'm, you know, I'm watching it, and it's like 5 mile an hour, southeast 5 miles an hour. I'm like, man, I'm going anyway. I'll come back early. And I don't come back early. I stay out there all damn day.
Famous last words.
I want to play with tarpon every chance I get.
Yeah.
Tarpon get into your blood. I mean, when you feel a tarpon, the initial strike, that initial run, the power, you know, just the raw power of it, and then they jump and they do their crazy acrobatics, it gets in you. You know, you want to do it again. It's a drug. Got to have it again. Got to get that high.
That makes sense. I've got a lot of years and a lot of dues to pay on the redfish side of things. So I'm not, and if I bought another boat, my wife would absolutely kill me right now. But you know what? You know, after I've been doing this for 20 years, maybe that'll be my next go to. The tarpon, I love the idea of it. I love the open water. And I have, now that I'm guiding, even though it's part time, I'll tell people I don't book paying trips in March. Because March is just sucks. It can be a hero or zero, just like that. I don't book paying trips in July. And it's usually July to that first. The first part of July sometimes can be good, but like that mid July to mid August is just, it's boiling water in the back lakes. It's fish are shutting down super early. Maybe it works. Maybe it doesn't. I don't like to book. You know, and I've got the day job, so I don't have to do that. But I was looking at your situation going, that makes a lot of sense, like, because the tarpon seem to fire up right when it's rough going, you know, with the redfish, and it makes a lot of sense. Have you had any other inklings to like, oh, there's this other thing out there that I need to go, there's this other itch I need to go scratch? I mean, I know you guide for whitetail deer at the ranch, you know, across the street from your house. And I know that kind of helps out with some of the cold weather stuff. But is there something else out there that you haven't tapped into yet that you're thinking about?
I've done the bull red thing over in Louisiana. I really enjoy that. I haven't done it for probably about 4 years now, but I did probably 6 years in a row where every January and February, I'd go over there and rent a house in Grand Isle, and all my regular customers would book me up, and they'd all come over and fish 2, 3, 4 days. A couple of them book a week at a time. And I'd rent a house. They stay at the house with me. It's almost like deer camp. You know, the guys are coming and going and I'm just there. And we're catching 20 to 30, 35 pound redfish in a foot, foot and a half, 2 foot of water. And it's almost all fly fishing. And it's just, that was a blast. And I'm kicking around doing that again. I've been back and forth about it. It's a very expensive venture for me to jump off into. If I catch a bad weather year, I can go backwards. I did that 1 year. By the time I rented the house, did all the, you know, the guide license to go over there is $1,500 for out-of-state guide license. All the food, the gas, everything to get over there, then renting a house for 2 months, a beach house rented for 2 months, you know. So I'm $6,000-$8,000 in before I ever get started. And that year, it snowed on me 3 times. Yes, it snowed on Grand Isle 3 times. Well, one was an ice storm, but yeah, it was nasty. It was the worst weather, and it was just cold, miserable. Every damn day was bad, and I had guys that were iced in. You know, my customers coming from Dallas, they're iced in. They can't come. Well, that was 4 days booking that just went out the window. Weather was fine down where I was. It hadn't hit me yet, but the guys couldn't make it. So that year, I canceled a ton of trips, and I think I broke even. I hate to even look at the actual numbers. But then there's other years when I ran every damn trip. You know, I was there for, I think I was there for 60 days. 1 year, I think it was 62 days, and I ran 54 of them.
Wow.
And I mean, that was an awesome year. I was wore out. But the cool part was that got me January, February, and got me off to a good start for the year. Where if I was in Texas, I'd have run maybe 4 or 5 trips a month during that period, because not a lot of people want to go fish in January and February, even though it's good. But that got me a good kickoff to the year. So when March and April rolled around, I ain't give a damn. I'm not booking a trip. It's going to be windy, and I don't feel like it. And I've already got some money in my pocket, so I'm good. But I'm kicking that around again. I do kind of miss it. Yeah, I didn't miss it the first year or two that I didn't go, because it's a lot to go over there and dedicate and say, I'm going to be away from home for 2 months.
Yeah.
And, you know, running trips. It's not a vacation. It's work. There's also some bull reds that I know are in the bays here, you know, in certain areas. Baffin in particular has its own resident population of bull reds. The problem with Baffin is it's so big and wide open, just getting to them day to day that time of year would be a little tough. And
yeah,
there's going to be a lot of days you get blown out and you just can't make it. So I kicked around trying it and giving it a shot. Maybe me and you go down there for 3 or 4 days and poke around and see if it's worthwhile.
Do a test run. Yeah.
Yeah, do some test runs. But also, I've kicked around. I mean, I know all up and down the coast, I've got places to fish. And I've kicked around going down there to Port Isabel area and doing some snook stuff.
Yeah. You
know, I understand the snook fishing. There's some guys that are way better at it than I am, but I think I can figure it out and get far enough along that I'd feel good about taking customers out and being able to take them in there and light tackle and fly fishing.
Yeah.
See if we can do something. Snooker right there behind tarpon for me. And they're a cool ass fish. They're a challenge. They're different. You know, I've done a lot of it in Belize. I've done a lot of it in Florida, all over the place, catching snook. Catching Texas snook is cool. You know, there's something a little different about that. I finally got my first 30-inch Texas snook a few years ago. That had been a goal. And I've got a lot bigger ones in Belize and in Florida, but getting a 30-inch Texas snook was high on my list.
Well, the Texas snook in general is kind of like it is – it does kind of have that rarity appeal to it, you know, and just speaking of the cost associated with guiding, you actually, again, like I said, you taught me everything I know, whether you meant to or not. We were talking about the insurance that you run. You get normal insurance on your boat. My insurance was $600 a year for my Poland skiff until I got my guide license. And I was like, Scott told me that the insurance is different. I called my insurance company and it went from $600 a year to $1,800 a year, all because I'm taking customers. And I'm like, well, that's a couple, 2 or 3 extra trips a year now. Yep. Whenever I'm doing it part time to pay for my place down in Bahia Vista and, you know, make all the ends meet. And also, you know, like I told you, my goal is to build a clientele so that when I retire, I can slide right into the, you know, do exactly what you're doing and go, look, this is what I want to do in retirement to bring in some extra cash. And I was like, there's some prohibitive cost involved in just doing it the way that you're supposed to do it. Because I learned early on, because you told me, and then I learned the hard way, you know, my casting platform, if I've got a new client on, I pull it off because I have had dudes almost eat it. I'm talking about like just inches away from an insurance claim, you know? And I'm like, oh my God, there's so many things you don't think about until you actually go to do it. And you're like, man, it's just nice having somebody like you who's done it all, seen it all, that I can go, man, I didn't see this coming and this happened the other day. What do you do? And you've always seen it. You've always dealt with it before. And that's been a really nice deal. What do you see for your, you know, you're a grandfather now, you're retired, you just built your new home down there in Port O'Connor. What's the plan for you? You going to keep doing this till you can't do it? Do you have your sights set on something else?
Well, I don't know how long I can keep pushing a boat from the Poland platform. When I screwed my shoulder up a couple of years ago, I thought that might be the end of it, but, my surgeon was really good and my rehab worked out and my shoulder feels better than it has in forever. I was actually throwing a football with one of the kids the other day and I hadn't been able to throw a ball in 10 years. And I was throwing football. Camille kept looking at me and she's watching me. She's like, are you sure you'd be doing that? Felt fine. Wasn't sore, nothing. Yeah. So shoulders in good shape.
You're 61?
No, I just turned 60.
Just turned 60. You're in great shape. I mean, well, there's no reason you couldn't keep doing this until for another 10 years.
We'll see. You know, kind of the long-term plan is keep pulling and, you know, as long as I can here. And, you know, the way guides work with boats, some guides, is buying a new boat every year and a half, 2 years, you know, and you buy it at your guide discount and you turn it and sell it. And then now you've got a little extra money. So you keep rolling it over. I think if I roll my general maybe 3 or 4 times, then I'll be free and clear. And if at that point I'll be in that, you know, mid to late 60s area. And then I may just sell the Poland's gift, have me a grandkid boat and go out there and just enjoy it and not have to worry about it anymore. Still probably run some trips, you know, just regular customers that have been with me for years and just take those. That's kind of where I see myself kind of sliding into eventually. I've got my photography as well and do my wildlife photography. I'm working on the ranch here to make it into a destination for wildlife watching and photography. I've got the whooping cranes that come on the property. Got all kind of birds. I'm working on building a wetlands area that will draw even more stuff in. And I think I can get into teaching on the photography side. And that would be a whole lot less stressful and easier on me, honestly, as I get a little older, being able to teach photography, teach wildlife photography. And there's a big market for it. There's a whole lot of people. Bird watching is huge. So being able to do that, like right now, I've got all kind of birds showing up on the property with the migration coming through. And I mean, birds you don't see, you know, any other time of year. You got orioles popping in and out and painted bunnings and just, you know, it's cool. It's cool to see all the different birds. They fly straight across from the Yucatan. And this is one of the first places that they land when they come across. And so they come here and then they chill out for 2 or 3 weeks and rest up and then keep on with their migration. So we're kind of the first trees that they see, because everything between me and the water is not trees. It's mostly marsh. And so I get what we call a fallout, and they just kind of fall in and hang out here for a few days and then move along. So I think if I do that, then I'll probably still be guiding some fishing trips and still be running some of that, but slowing it down.
Yeah.
I mean, I've slowed it down already. Be perfectly honest with you. I don't book Saturdays. Don't try to book me on a Saturday. I'm not going to do it. Sundays are iffy. Fridays, I'm not crazy about. I prefer to run Monday through Thursday, and you know, come see me during the week, and we can go out there and have a lot less competition and a lot less frustration of people running you over. But if I mean, right now, if I run 120 days a year, that's fine.
Yeah.
You know, it's about right. It's about what I need to run, 120 to 150 days a year. When I first started and got serious about it, I did it like you, part-time. Started when I was still in the police department, and then I was doing the sales rep thing and kind of bouncing around with some other stuff. And then when I finally quit all the sales rep and said, okay, I'm going, you know, I had enough clientele, I'm going 100%, you know, full-time. There was a couple of years there I ran 250, 260 days a year.
Wow.
That'll wear you out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I could feel myself burning out. Yeah. I could feel it that I'm pushing a boat all day, every day like that. And that's kind of when I started thinking I needed to look at something else. And then the tarpon thing came along, the guiding deer hunts came along. Give me some variety where I'm not doing the same thing every day.
That makes sense. I've got a Scott Noel photography red robin hanging in the center. It's the centerpiece of my of my office here. I'm looking at it. You guys can't see it on the camera, but yeah, it's a beautiful picture. It's funny. I hung that picture on the wall, and a couple weeks after I hung it, a red robin made a nest and started living in the bushes just outside of my office. And I see that bird probably 2 or 3 times a week. But you know, you have, I can imagine that it's probably not something that you maybe intended. But I guess maybe you knew it was possible, because I know that there were people that you looked up to in the fishing industry, but you have become, for many people, myself included, the flip palette of our generation. You've become, you know, the lefty. You've created in the fishing industry, you are one of the icons that folks are looking to as, you know, a patriarch of especially the redfish world and also some of the tarpon. Did you ever envision that would happen? Is that something you strived for? And how do you feel about it now that it's kind of happened?
I still don't believe it. I still don't think of myself in any of those terms. And I've got to meet Flip, and I've got to hang out with Lefty and Flip and some of those guys. And, you know, that's how I felt about them. You know, but they had such a laid back attitude. And it was like, they didn't know. They never came off as, hey, I'm Flip Pallet. Hey, I'm Lefty Cray. I mean, Lefty Cray, when I met him, I was being introduced to him by the owner of TFO Rods at a fly fishing show. And Lefty stood up and reached out to shake my hand and said, hi, I'm Lefty Cray. I'm like, I'm well aware of who you are, man.
Like, I know.
And so now that, I mean, Camille laughs at me because I have a hard time believing that many people know me or follow me, or it's just like, I don't understand why sometimes, you know, everybody wants to follow along. And I mean, people hit me up all the time. They know things. It's kind of spooky at times. You know, people know my dog, you know, they know I was building a house. They know, you know, all those things. I'm an open book, so it's not too surprising, I guess. But having people stop me at Academy, HEB in Port Lavaca, you know, hey, Captain Scott, how's it going? I'm like, wait, what? Why do you know me? It catches me off guard. It really does, because I don't think of myself in that way, in any way, shape, or form. I just do what I do and enjoy myself and have fun, you know, and help people out when I can, you know, helping you out, helping anybody out that comes to me in a genuine sense, I'll help them out. You know, I've been burned a few times. You know, it's happened. We've had that discussion. A couple of young guides, you know, kind of took advantage of my generosity and my friendship. But for the most part, I can read people pretty good, and I like doing it. You know, I like seeing somebody else succeed. You know, there's a whole lot of people in this world that get jealous or don't like to see anybody succeed. I mean, I've got people that, you know, mad at me that, you know, full-time guides have been guiding a long time, and they didn't follow the same path that I did. And they're real closed mouthed and closed off, and they don't like seeing somebody else succeed and get any attention of any kind. I like it. I like seeing it. You know, I've helped a lot of people along. You know, I like seeing old Caleb McCumber, as goofy as he is. You know, it's fun to see him getting out there and succeeding. You know, I like watching it. I think I told you that I was walking through the airport in Seattle and had somebody recognize me in Seattle in the airport.
Yeah.
I was on my way to Alaska to go, you know, go photograph bears. And this dude just stops me. Hey, are you Captain Scott? Yeah. He said, I listened to the podcast and knew you were coming up this way. I figured you had to fly through here, and I was flying out. And so I started looking for you. It's like, holy hell.
I tell you what, man, the Buy Me podcast has exceeded all expectations of what kind of reach a fishing podcast can have. It's crazy. Truly been amazing. And I think, you know, John does a great job of moderating and the whole cast of characters, they're amazing, but it started with you and John. And I feel like when people tune in, there's a large swath of those people that want to learn something. And like I mentioned before, you've consistently, you speak about the ecosystem and the marsh in a way that drops little breadcrumbs to where if you're out there and you're seeing what's going on, it all starts to click. It all starts to make sense. And you begin speaking the language yourself. And that's what I did. I made a huge impact on me and just the way that I am able to enjoy, you know, the fishery. And I look at it in a way that, like, you know, when I'm out there, you know, and in the areas that I stomp around, in the areas that you used to stomp around, I think about it in the sense that, look, Scott tread over these marshes and he took care of these fish and did right by this ecosystem. And I'm going to try to do the same thing. And I think that, you know, that mentality going forward is important for not just the redfish, but for the identity of the angler. Like there will be no more Scott Knowles in the future if we don't take care of the fishery and we don't, you know, treat the business of guiding and the ecosystem in a way that it's, you know, worthy of being treated, you know. Yep. Not everybody out there is, you know, doing it right. And when I saw you and got to know you, I thought, this is a guy that cares not just about the ecosystem, but about his customers and the experience they have on the water. And it's more than just how many fish can we throw in the cooler? How many, you know, how quick can we catch our limit? And that's what allured me to the sport in general. And I think that your impact on it is hard to understate. I think you've really built, you know, intending to or not, I think it probably just happens when someone's passionate about what they do and they do a good job with it. But, you know, I've said before, and I shamelessly have, you know, followed in your footsteps to you know, a point where maybe some people would go, "Hey, look, that's a little weird." But I'm like, look, when you find someone who's doing it the way you want to do it, you follow suit. You know, I bought a Sabine skiff. I'm fishing, you know, some of your old areas, and that part was, I was doing before we met, but you know, I look at that and I go, there are going to be people out there that listen to my dinky little podcast that want to do what I'm doing. And I hope that, that they see the same passion in me that I see in you, and that they take care, they learn to take care of the ecosystem in the same way that I'm learning to take care of it, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'm very passionate about trying to get other guys to understand that it's not all about catch and keep and how many fish we can pile up and how, you know, we're not commercial fishermen selling fillets, and we're teachers, or you should be. People should be learning something when they go out on your boat. Even if it's a bad day, just learn knots, learn what flies you like to throw, learn what lures you like to throw and why. I'm constantly telling people when we're polling an area why I'm going into this place. You know, what we just checked out is different from what we're fixing to check out. We didn't find any fish over there. I'm going from a mud area to a sandy area, or an area that's got more shell in it, an area that's got a different wind. You know, the wind's pounding this place. Let's go try one that's, you know, protected. Just kind of throwing little tidbits out there, you know, as we go, just to hope that they're learning something. And quite often I get people that just shake their head at the end of the day. And it's just like, man, I learned a ton today. And that's what makes me feel good. Something else is, as far as taking care of the area, I would go back there into that marsh and on my days off, you know, and just sit and pole, sit on my platform, watch the fish, watch the birds, watch all that stuff. And as I was learning pole and skiff, but I'd also pick up every piece of trash that was back there. You know, I'd be poling along, picking up the trash. And I would have customers that would actually comment on that. They'd say, hey, this area back here is pristine. You know, it's so pretty back here, and there's no trash anywhere. There's no nothing. I said, yeah, I pick it up every day. You know, I hate to say it, but during duck season, good God, the duck hunters are the trashiest folks everywhere. I mean, they would just leave styrofoam cups and coffee cups and crap all over the place. And I'd be cleaning up every day during duck season. I'd be cleaning up. But yeah, I mean, it was my backyard. I considered the Greens and Pierce Marshes. That was my backyard. That's where I spent more time there than I spent at home. So why wouldn't I take care of it?
Yeah.
And there's always been this feeling among some folks when they first start fishing, there's an unlimited supply, infinite supply of fish out there. You know, it's an ocean. We got just so many fish. I've watched the populations, and the populations going down. You know, mm-hmm. like on trout, say what you want. You know, a lot of younger guys are saying, man, trout fishing's fine. It's as good as it can get. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I've seen it way better. Before I got into redfish, I was a hardcore trout guy. And trout fishing is nothing compared with what it used to be. It's not much compared with what it was 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And it wasn't as good then as it was when I started. Redfish, on the other hand, when I first started, there were no redfish.
Yeah.
I mean, we didn't have redfish. You know, in the late 70s, they were being gill netted. You couldn't run back there in Greens where you run. You'd run into a gill net. You know, running those bayous. You'd
really?
Hit gill net. Oh, yeah. You'd tie your boat up in a gill net.
Oh, wow.
All those little openings. Every time in the fall, when those fish fall out of there, you know, on those fallen tides, every one of those bayous would have a gill net across it. And they
caught
everything that came through.
And that's insane.
I mean, it was a big deal. I think it was summer 78 or 79, somewhere around in there. I was wade fishing a lot. You know, I worked at Marburger Sporting Goods and knew a lot of people, got off into the fishing pretty heavy. And all my buddies fished. And I caught one redfish that summer, and it was a big deal. I mean, like a huge deal. Like, call your buddies. I caught a redfish. You know, fishing over in Christmas Bay, we caught it. I caught a redfish. That was the coolest thing. Now, trout, yeah, we caught, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60, 100 trout a day. But redfish, there just wasn't that many. But there wasn't so much of a market for trout.
Yeah.
But the market was really big for redfish. Paul Prudhomme and the black and redfish thing just about made redfish extinct. They were running off the beachfronts in big boats and spotter planes and finding the big schools and rounding them up with seines. It was bad. It was really, really bad. CCA came along, and that's why I know people disagree with me on CCA. There's a lot of people that don't like what they do, you know, for whatever reason. They've done something to tick them off. I don't agree with everything that CCA does. I don't agree with every stance they take, but I will never go against CCA, because without them, we wouldn't have any fish to be fishing for right now.
Yeah. I mean, somebody's got to do something, right? I mean, most of the guys that are mad about what CCA is doing are guys that are sitting on their hands doing nothing.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what I ask them. I mean, I'm pretty direct about it. When they get off into that, that's one of the joys of getting to be 60 years old now. I don't give a damn if I tick somebody off that I really don't like.
Yeah.
You know, that I don't, I don't like them. I don't respect what they do.
Yeah.
Let's say it that way. You know, they're going out there every day and they're just raping and pillaging. You know, kill as many fish as we can kill today, and then go out and do it again this afternoon, or go out and do it again tomorrow. Don't care how they do it. Don't care how it, you know, don't teach anybody anything. Just take them to a spot, throw some croaker out and catch some fish, and that's it.
Yep.
I'll ask them flat out when they start bitching about CCA or Parks and Wildlife cutting limits or what, you know, during all this limit stuff, I had a whole bunch of them coming at me with, well, it's not about how many fish we're taking out. It's about the habitat. It's about this, you know, the habitat's degraded. So of course we don't have as many fish. I don't really understand their argument there as to why they should still be able to keep the same amount.
Yeah. But
I would turn to them and just look at them and say, and what have you done today to make it better? What'd you do last week to make it better? What'd you do in the last month to make it better? Okay, what have you done in the last year to make it better?
Yep.
And they got no answer because they're takers.
They're just out there taking every day.
Yeah. And I don't know. It's not my way. It's, you know, it's part of me. I mean, that's part of why I was on the police department. You know, help people, help the situation, help everything. I've always done that. You know, I've always been on that side of things. In school, you know, when the bully's picking on the weaker kid or the weird kid, I was the one that jumped in and got in trouble fighting the bully.
Yeah.
Because, you know, but I don't know. I don't want to pat myself on the back on it or anything, but it's just the way I'm wired and the way I've always done things. And now it's transferred over into fishing and the environment and talking on behalf of the fish.
Yeah. Well, listen, maybe this worked out for the best. I told you I was going to take an hour of your time tops. We're at an hour and 36 minutes, which I had a feeling might happen. But I'm not going to have you tell the Quanah Lake story. Because that is a little breadcrumb that we will drop to ensure that you are bound and shackled to do this again at some future date.
No problem.
Because I would love to have you on again. With all of the things that you do and with the thing you have going with the Bite Me podcast and all that, I cannot tell you how much it means to me that you would take the time to do an interview with this dinky little Empty Stringers podcast. I very much appreciate it. I appreciate all that you have taught me and the way you've kind of just tucked me under your wing and said, hey, listen, here's how you do this and here's how you do that. It has changed the way I do everything. I greatly appreciate it. And, you know, people say don't meet your heroes. But that has not been the case with you. You've been just the best. And I consider you a dear friend. So thanks for taking the time to do the podcast. And this will air on Thursday. So I'll get all the editing and stuff done. But, you know, I've got you on the hook now. You got to come back and do one.
As a little teaser for your folks, yes, I put my handcuffs on Quan LX.
Yes. It is a great story. I'm a little saddened that we're not going to tell it here, but it makes it even better for when we tell it down the road. So please give Camille a big hug for me. Tell her thank you for she's in Houston, right? So she's not sitting on the couch waiting for you to finish.
Nah, she's over at Randy's house. She's grand dog sitting.
Gotcha.
Randy's okay. Out of town.
Good stuff. Well, Scott, listen, man, I really appreciate it. Thanks for taking the time, and we'll be in touch soon.
Sounds good, man.
All right, brother. Take care.
You too.